historicengland.org.uk/disability history.
For historical accuracy, this research has used language in the context of the time period being explored. Words used to describe different types of disability at different times can sound offensive to modern ears. During this recording, we'll explain the definitions of these words as used at the time.
Disability in the early 20th century, 1914 to 1945. This section describes the tension between different attitudes to disability at the beginning of the 20th century. The return home of disabled ex-servicemen from World War I challenged the widespread idea that disabled people were a burden. Eugenics, the science of improving the human race. In 1930, Julian Huxley, secretary of the London Zoological Society and chairman of the Eugenics Society, wrote, "What are we going to do? Every defective man, woman, and child is a burden. Every defective is an extra body for the nation to feed and clothe, but produces little or nothing in return." In the early 20th century, many public figures agreed with the idea of eugenics. They believed that anyone disabled or deficient was a threat to the health of the nation. The aim of eugenics was to eliminate human physical and mental defects altogether in order to build a stronger society. People with disabilities would be segregated from everyone else in the name of perfecting the human race.
Eugenics, a movement prevalent in the later half of the 19th century and first half of the 20th century. Based on the writings of Francis Galton, eugenicists believed in the sterilization or even euthanasia of disabled people and others such as the mentally ill or morally degenerate, to prevent what they described as racial deterioration. They believed that degeneration was due to genetic inheritance. Defective, term used in the early 20th century to describe a person who would be described today as having a learning disability.
The return of the disabled heroes. When almost 2 million newly disabled British ex-servicemen came home from the battlefronts of the First World War, some attitudes had to change. They were heroes who had sacrificed their bodies for the nation. These are some of the ways society adapted to their return. There were major advances in plastic surgery and prosthetics. Ex-servicemen with physical and mental damage were treated with new exercise and fitness approaches. Employers were urged to take on disabled workers, and at the same time sheltered employment workplaces sprang up, including the British Legion Poppy Factory in South London. New housing was built for disabled ex-servicemen, ranging from single cottages to entire special villages.
Prosthetics, the use of artificial replacements for missing body parts, particularly limbs. Sheltered work. Work for disabled people taking place in specialist work settings separate from mainstream workplaces.
Colonies for disabled people. Despite these changes, disabled civilians didn't always benefit. Rural colonies were established for people with learning disabilities. At that time, they were known as the mentally deficient. The colonies were self-contained small worlds in which disabled people were isolated from the outside world. They lived in villas that housed up to 60 men, women, and children. There were farms, laundries, bakeries, recreation halls, chapels, and mortuaries. Segregation by sex, age, and ability was strict.
Colonies, a type of asylum institution established by the 1913 Mental Deficiency Act, where both adults and children with learning disabilities lived in a village arrangement of a number of villas, each housing up to 60 people. Villas, used to describe the separate ward buildings housing up to 60 people in pavilion design asylums, particularly mental deficiency colonies.
Children. Between 1900 and 1945, up to 500,000 children had a physical disability or sensory impairment, mainly due to poverty and disease. There were no vaccinations, and many working-class families couldn't afford specialist equipment or treatment. Everyone now had the right to education. Schools for crippled, blind, and deaf children could be harsh, but there were some new approaches. Progressive Sunshine Homes looked after blind children, and open-air schools were believed to improve children's health. Disabled children were trained for low-skilled work, but most people thought they would never find a job.
crippled, a term used to describe physically disabled people, until the second half of the 20th century. Cripple is its early English form, used in the medieval period. Now used pejoratively or abusively. Open-air school. A type of school introduced to England from Germany in the early 20th century, where pupils spent much of their time learning outdoors. It was believed that fresh air would be beneficial to delicate and disabled children.
The return to war in 1939. When the Second World War began, many employed people signed up to fight. There was now an urgent shortage of workers, and the Ministry of Labour launched a recruitment drive. It was aimed at people who had been considered unfit for work. Life was about to change again for people with disabilities. The impact of the First World War. This section explains how Britain adapted to the challenge of the huge numbers of First World War ex-servicemen who came home permanently disabled by their wounds. The human cost. By the end of the First World War, almost 1 million British soldiers, sailors and airmen had been killed. However, nearly another 2 million had been permanently disabled, over 40,000 had lost legs or arms. All these people needed medical treatment, ongoing care and work or financial support in order to survive in peacetime. New limbs, plastic surgery and exercise. Artificial limbs were urgently required, but the ones on offer were heavy and made of wood. The Disabled Society campaigned for light aluminium limbs instead, and Queen Mary's Hospital in Roehampton, London, the main English limb-fitting hospital for ex-servicemen, fitted more and more each year. Plastic surgeon Sir Harold Gillies pioneered facial surgery at Queen's Hospital in Sidcup, Kent. The artist Francis Derwent Wood worked there with him, creating masks for burn patients whose faces could not be fully restored by surgery. Meanwhile, exercise and sport were increasingly used to help men recover. At the Croydon Union Workhouse Infirmary in Surrey, renamed the Mayday Hospital in the 1920s, Colonel Dean set up a gymnastic exercise centre for disabled ex-servicemen.
More information about Queen Mary's Hospital at https://www.heritagegateway.org.uk/gateway/results_single.asp(x?marque)id=D95 6EE21-1D94-45CB8D26-9924C9FF66A2. Resource ID equals 19911. More information about Queen's Hospital at https://historicengland.org.uk/listing/the-list/list-entry/106422-8. More information about Croydon Union Workhouse Infirmary at https://www.heritagegateway.org.uk/gateway/results_single.asp(x?marque)id=9F08038-0CCA4044C-8716-415ABA3DE991 =19191.
Learning new skills. Now the fighting was over, ex-servicemen needed new skills. St. Dunstan's in Regent's Park, London, housed a total of 1,833 blinded ex-servicemen as they recovered, learning new skills and exercising. People were intrigued, they often visited the men and accompanied them to concerts and theatres. Another home for disabled soldiers and sailors, the Star and Garter in Richmond, Surrey, opened in 1916. Some ex-servicemen worked on a poultry farm known as No Man's Land, as part of their retraining.
More information about St. Dunstan's at https://historicengland.org.uk/listing/the-list/list-entry/138941. More information about the Star and Garter at https://www.heritagegateway.org.uk https://gateway/results_single.asp_x?marc_uid=D86435-7C-9811-44BB-A2A9-70A0D2B2 8B09 ampersand. Resource ID equals 19911.
Work. Most disabled people couldn't find work unless it was in sheltered employment set up especially for them. Ex-servicemen trained as limb fitters at Roehampton, and the British Legion opened its poppy factory in Richmond, Surrey. The King's National Role, a 1919 scheme that encouraged firms to employ disabled ex-servicemen, had little success. In 1927, a training school for war disabled taxi drivers was set up in London.
More information about Roehampton at https://www.heritagegateway.org.uk/gateway/results_single.asp_x?marc_uid=D95 6EE21-194-45 CB8D26-9924C9FF6684C9FF6684C9FF6681 ampersand. Resource ID equals 19911. More information about the Poppy Factory at https://www.heritagegateway.org.uk/gateway/results_single.asp_x?marc_uid=0C6E086B-69F6-49F19-3C8-41ADF8F3AE4C ampersand. Resource ID equals 19911.
Housing. A network of special villages was built for ex-servicemen and their families. These included Hague Homes in Welwyn Garden City, Westfield War Memorial Village in Lancaster, and the Enham Village settlement near Andover in Hampshire. In 1920, the public raised funds for 12 new cottages in Sprowston near Norwich for disabled members of the Royal Norfolk Regiment. In 1927, the Prince of Wales opened Leicester's North Memorial Homes, which provided 35 homes for disabled ex-servicemen.
More information about the Hague Homes at https://www.heritagegateway.org.uk/gateway/results_single.asp_x?marc_uid=1EEE34F1-FBB8-4972-952-9C-9F42E9 6DFEF4C ampersand. Resource ID equals 19911. More information about Westfield War Memorial Village at https://historicengland.org.uk/listing/the-list/list-entry/119-5055. More information about Enham Village Settlement at https://historicengland.org.uk/listing/the-list/list-entry/126469. More information about Sprowston at https://historicengland.org.uk/listing/the-list/list-entry/139342-5. More information about North Memorial Homes at https://www.heritagegateway.org.uk/gateway/results_single.asp_x?marc_uid=F417103-5-B675-48A8-9C3B3CC09F62E23 ampersand. Resource ID equals 19911.
Sharing resources. Some of the developments for ex-servicemen eventually benefited other people. Disabled civilians were offered the new artificial limbs. Specialist medical facilities for disabled miners were introduced in the 1920s. Treatment for people injured at work was considered in the 1930s. Pensions and work opportunities for disabled ex-servicemen were limited, but some people felt that whatever resources were available should be more evenly shared with the wider disabled population. At a conference on the care of crippled children in 1920, it was claimed that provision for the war disabled had caused an appalling amount of suffering among other disabled people. Mental deficiency between the wars. Life in the colony. This section describes how work opportunities for people with disabilities were substantially reduced after the First World War as ex-servicemen returned to the labor market. The government's solution was to house disabled people in rural mental deficiency colonies where they lived and worked, isolated from society.
Mental deficiency, a term used mainly in the first part of the 20th century, and broadly having the same meaning as the current term learning disability.
The problems of peace. As the First World War raged across Europe, Leslie Scott, the chairman of the Central Association for the Care of the Mentally Defective, began to think about the problems that peace might bring. In November 1917, he wrote, "There are large numbers of low-grade, even imbecile defectives, now in remunerative work who will assuredly leave their work when there is any displacement of labor, and we are anxious to make plans for their protection."
Imbecile. When classification systems were introduced in the 19th century, imbecile was used to denote the medium rank of intelligence and functional ability amongst people with learning disabilities, between idiot and moron. Similar to what we would define as a severe learning disability today. In the 19th century, could also be used to describe a person with mental illness. Today used pejoratively or abusively.
Useful members of the workforce. Before the First World War, the mentally deficient had been seen as incapable of work. But when thousands of employed people signed up to fight, people with disabilities were left behind and found to be useful members of the workforce for the first time. As the war drew to a close, this was about to change. Ex-servicemen were coming home from the front, and they wanted their jobs back. Isolation in separate colonies. The science of eugenics was in fashion at this time. Those who believed in eugenics argued that defective members of the population would cause a general degeneration of the country's racial stock unless they were kept strictly controlled and segregated, and if possible, sterilized. In line with this thinking, the 1913 Mental Deficiency Act set up a new board of control. It specified that mental defectives should either be closely supervised in the community or kept in a new type of institution. They're a mental deficiency colony. As a result, a network of small, self-contained, scattered villages was established across the country to provide permanent settlements for children and adults.
Degeneration. A theory propounded by eugenicists in the late 19th and 20th centuries that breeding by people who have disabilities, mentally ill people, or people who are seen as feckless or idle, particularly those from the poorer classes, will cause general racial deterioration in a society. Sterilized. Surgical procedure to make men or women infertile. Advocated by the eugenics movement for people viewed as mentally and sometimes physically or morally degenerate or deficient. Board of Control. Government body established under the Mental Deficiency Act 1913 to replace the Lunacy Commission and to oversee the treatment of mentally ill people and people with learning disabilities.
Grading people with disabilities. People with learning disabilities were now graded. At the bottom were the idiots, the profoundly disabled, and the imbeciles, the medium grade. As well as these, there were two types of feeble-minded people. The first were mildly disabled but able to support themselves to some extent. The second were the so-called moral defectives. It was said they cannot distinguish right from wrong and represent a grave danger to the community.
Idiots. When classification systems were introduced in the 19th century, idiot was used to denote the lowest rank of intelligence and functional ability, similar to what we would define as a profound learning disability today. In earlier English used to describe dull-witted people, who could be seen as broadly equivalent to what we would define as having a learning disability, but could be used in a wider sense to describe the laboring classes and the peasantry. Today used pejoratively or abusively. Imbeciles. was used to denote the medium rank of intelligence and functional ability amongst people with learning disabilities, between idiot and moron. Similar to what we would define as a severe learning disability today. In the 19th century, could also be used to describe a person with mental illness. Today used pejoratively or abusively. Feeble-minded. A term used in the late 19th and early 20th centuries to describe people who would be described today as having moderate or mild learning disabilities, or, as it was also known at the time, high-grade mental deficiency. Moral defectives. A category of people defined in the early 20th century broadly similar to moral imbecility, whose perceived deficiencies were seen as linked to genetic inheritance.
Living in the colonies. In a typical colony, 900 to 1,500 people lived in detached villas with up to 60 people in each. It was thought essential to separate the sexes, so a central administrative block always formed a barrier between the male and female villas. In all of them, patients slept in multiple rows in large dormitories. There were special villas for difficult cases, people whose behavior was thought to need controlling, and for the lowest grade idiots. These villas were as far away as possible from the entrances to the hospital to avoid offending visitors. The idiots didn't work, they stayed in their villas, but as these had verandas, they could be out in the fresh air even in bad weather. Villas housing the better class of working patients were allowed to be furthest from the administrative block and had their own cooking and heating facilities. No one need ever leave. Children lived separately and had their own schools where they learned useful occupational skills for their future lives as adults in the colony. There were workshops for the adults, as well as kitchens, a bakery, a laundry, a recreation hall, seating up to 750 patients and doubling as a chapel, staff quarters, playing fields, particularly for the males, and a small mortuary. Work. Many colonies had their own farms with market gardens, stables, poultry, pigs, herds of cows and greenhouses, and most patients worked, unpaid, in the laundries and workshops, or on the farm. The colonies brought in staff too. As well as nurses, they employed farm bailiffs, firemen, engineers and, of course, gatekeepers. In 1939 another war came, and some colonists left to work, or even fight. But the colonies would live on until the 1990s. The right to education, the growth of the special school for children with disabilities. In this section we explore how children with disabilities gained the right to education in the early 20th century. For some it was progressive and highly innovative, but for others, it could be a brutal experience. The move towards special education. Local authorities had been responsible for educating blind and deaf children since 1893. The 1918 Education Act made schooling for all disabled children compulsory. It was a very significant piece of legislation. By 1921, there were more than 300 institutions for blind, deaf, crippled, tubercular, and epileptic children. It was often thought that children with disabilities were better off away from their families, so even though a small number of them stayed in mainstream education, many left home to go off to residential schools.
Tubercular. Having tuberculosis, an infectious disease of the lungs. Epileptic. Suffering from epilepsy, a neurological disorder which can cause loss of consciousness or convulsions. Originally known as falling sickness. Mainstream education. Generally available public education aimed at all children.
Improvements in children's health. From Germany, the idea of the open-air school came to England. Sick or disabled children studied in outdoor classrooms. Their diet was improved. Even in winter, wrapped in blankets, they took their afternoon naps outside. The first of these schools was opened in 1907 by London County Council at Bostall Woods, Woolwich. By 1939, there were 150 open-air schools, providing places for almost 20,000 children. And here, away from unhealthy, crowded home environments, their health began to improve.
More information about Bostall Woods at https://www.heritagegateway.com. https://gateway/results_single.asp(x?marquid=73C4C6B8-CB08-4A35-AB8A-2BC6955C5001 Resource ID equals 19191.
Progressive and innovative schools. The Royal National Institute for the Blind, RNIB, set up a network of Sunshine Homes which pioneered liberal and progressive teaching and care methods. The first was opened in 1918 in Chorleywood, Hertfordshire, with an intake of 25 blind infants. The Chile Heritage Craft School in East Sussex was founded in 1903 under the banner of the Guild of the Brave Poor Things, a self-help group for young disabled people. The school took in disabled children from deprived city areas and taught them crafts in a countryside setting, with the aim of helping them become independent adults.
More information about Chorleywood at https://www.heritagegateway.org.uk/gateway/results_single.asp(x)marquid=614E1430-15B-4678-83DC5504224238BD9 Resource ID equals 19191. More information about Chile Heritage Craft School at https://www.heritagegateway.org.uk/gateway/results_single.asp(x)marquid=abf6efdc-5592-4C7-1-9f5f-36332484A87 Resource ID equals 19191.
Harsh disciplinarian regimes. Although the right to education was a great step forward for disabled children, in practice it was sometimes a mixed blessing. There was often a focus on low-skilled work training rather than full education, and many educational regimes could be harsh and highly disciplinarian. Parental visits were discouraged and letters home were censored. In 1915, a group of blind boys made a nighttime escape from the Mount School for the Blind and Deaf in Stoke-on-Trent, Staffordshire. They wanted to contribute to the war effort by working on a farm, but they were caught. Back at school, they were forced to hand in their trousers each night to stop them escaping again. They were also placed with the deaf children as a punishment. The blind children couldn't see, and the deaf children couldn't hear, so they struggled to communicate.
More information about Mount School for the Blind and Deaf at https://www.heritagegateway.org.uk/gateway/results_single.asp(x)marquid=0C7C3DE5-F93C-4E17-B16-077627D5D10A& Resource ID equals 19191.
A combative atmosphere. Such harshness often led to aggressive attitudes between staff and pupils. Pupils at the Manchester Road School for the Blind in Sheffield, South Yorkshire, went on a two-day strike after a pupil was severely disciplined for something he had not done. Although deaf children preferred to sign, they were often required to learn to lip-read. At the Yorkshire Residential Institute for the Deaf in Doncaster, pupils used sign language in secret so they could retain some independence. The sexes were always rigorously separated, but boys and girls still found ways to communicate with each other. We know, for example, that pupils from the Halliwick Home for Crippled Girls in Edmonton, North London, would often slip crumpled notes to the choirboys on their weekly visits to church.
More information about Halliwick Home for Crippled Girls at https://www.heritagegateway.org.uk/gateway/results_single.asp(x)marquid=8ACF2217-80F1-40CD-B-61564FAC757D Resource ID equals 19191.
Everyday life and work, disabled people in the community in the early 20th century. This section describes how it became more difficult for people with disabilities to live and work in their communities in the early 20th century as society's fear of the spread of feeble-mindedness led to increased governmental control. A difficult time. In the first half of the 20th century, the number of disabled people in institutions grew, but the majority remained in their communities. However, it was a difficult time for them. Society was fearful of the spread of feeble-mindedness, a term associated with people with physical, mental, and sensory disabilities. The government increased their levels of supervision over disabled people. If people classified as mentally deficient were not placed in an institution, they were submitted to close control in the community. Someone to watch over you. The Central Association for Mental Welfare, a voluntary organization, would identify people who were believed to be deficient and visit those who were under close supervision. This work was carried out by teams of volunteers and officials on behalf of the government's Board of Control in Victoria Street, London. Enthusiastic local branches identified large numbers of deficient people for supervision, 351 in Buckinghamshire and 930 in Somerset in 1925. One woman recalled a certain Mr. Gray who visited her. Gray. Who I hated him. He wouldn't let anybody live. He did a lot of damage, picking up people what didn't deserve to be picked up.
More information about the Board of Control in Victoria Street at https://www.heritagegateway.org.uk/gateway/results_single.aspx?mark UID=26DB96825CC4 0BF-AD37-B2A17B955C4 9 & Resource ID=19191.
Preventing sex and marriage. The prevention of sexual relationships and marriage was a particular concern. In Rotherham in 1926, Mabel M., a defective, and her boyfriend, Thomas L., a coal miner, applied for a marriage license. Mabel M.'s mother was opposed to the marriage and the Board of Control ruled that no certificate is to be issued. Widespread disability and impairment. From 1907, compulsory examinations in schools highlighted the extent of physical disability and sensory impairment, particularly amongst working-class children. The problems of poverty, poor housing, sanitation, healthcare and diet, and the lack of immunization took their toll. Between the 1900s and 1950s, an estimated 500,000 boys and girls had disabilities, often caused by diseases such as polio and tuberculosis.
Polio. Poliomyelitis, infectious viral disease affecting the central nervous system, which can cause temporary or permanent paralysis. First identified in the 19th century, there were major epidemics across Europe throughout the 20th century. A common childhood disease and cause of disability in England until its eradication through a vaccination program, which began in the 1960s.
Daily life. Disabled children were also often lonely. I had no friends in the village. I used to go around more on a level with the dogs. I had to cross my legs over and use them like a shovel to get about, recalled a Doncaster man when talking about his life in the 1920s. Others had happier memories. Two churches were designed specifically with deaf and disabled people in mind, so they could access the same services in the community as non-disabled people. Built for the Royal Association in Aid of the Deaf and Dumb by Edward Morph in the 1920s, St. Bede's Church in Clapham and St. Saviour's in Acton have dual pulpits, one for the chaplain, one for the interpreter, bright lighting and raked seating so everyone could see. St. Saviour's is still used as a deaf church.
More information about St. Saviour's at https://londondeafchurch.wordpress.com/useful-info/st-saviours-history.
Low status. A culture of low expectations in schools for deaf, blind and crippled children led many of them into low-skilled, repetitive jobs in sheltered workshops, if they were able to find any work at all. But some adults protested about their status and treatment. In 1920 and again in 1933, blind workers marched to London from all over Britain to hold mass demonstrations against low wages and poor working conditions. In the workforce again. In 1941, the Ministry of Labour, faced with acute shortages, recruited more than 300,000 previously unemployable disabled people into the workforce. Once again, war was changing everything, as it had in the First World War. "Cripples can do vital war work," ran a newspaper headline. Within months of reading it, a Northumbrian woman with cerebral palsy was working at a Royal Ordnance factory. "It was a wonderful feeling," she said. "I reveled in being my own mistress at last."